Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon with Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will be joining us later in the hour. But we open the program today with a conversation with singer-songwriter David Rovics. We'll discuss the role of music and struggles for human rights and social justice, and we'll also listen to some of David's recent songs. Later in the program, Mickey Huff will join us to give a report about the recent National Whistleblower Conference in Washington, D.C. Mickey will also tell us about the 2015 edition of our annual Project Censored book on unreported and underreported news. And we'll wrap up today's show with some audio segments from Project Censored, the movie. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. Today we're going to be interviewing David Rovics. He's a protest singer and has two new CDs out. And then later in the show, we'll be hearing from Mickey on his trip to Washington, D.C. and the National Whistleblowers Conference. So, Nolan, you introduce David Rovics.
David Rovics grew up in a family of classical musicians in Wilton, Connecticut. By the early 90s, he was a full-time busker in the Boston subways, and by the mid-90s, he was traveling the world as a professional flat-picking rabble-rouser. These days, David lives in Portland, Oregon, and tours regularly on four continents, playing for audiences large and small at cafes, pubs, universities, churches, union halls, and protest rallies. His music has been featured on Democracy Now!, the BBC, Al Jazeera, and other networks. His essays are published regularly on Counterpunch and elsewhere. David Rovics, welcome to the Project Censored Show. Now, David, tell our listeners a little bit about the historical roots of your kind of music.
What people have been doing since the 1300s in the English language is, in terms of what's recorded, is writing songs about what's happening around them. And what's happening around us is war and imperialism and poverty and all sorts of things that are everyday reality for people in this country and around the world. And I write about those things that are happening outside of my bedroom, you know, which makes me a protest singer. But I write about these things because it can affect people, because people can hear a song and in 3 minutes their perspective on something can change in a way that's unlikely to happen through any other means of communication. And also, music has the power to inspire people who are already involved in social change to keep on going. And that's another thing that most other forms of communication don't do.
David, we're about to play your song Gaza. What can you tell us about your song Gaza before we have our listeners hear it?
It's a song about what life has been like in the Gaza Strip during so-called peacetime.
Okay, well, let's move forward. Let's hear that song, and we'll get right back to you, and we'll hear more of your music.
Million people surrounded on all sides, refugees since 48, since 67 occupied. The only reason they're not starving is down to the UN. Most have never left, they're stuck in the lion's den, the most crowded place on earth, and there they'll stay. They can't visit cousins half hours drive away. Drones overhead constantly. Who will die tomorrow? A daily mystery in Gaza. The settlers moved out, the fighter jets moved in. In Gaza, there's just no way that you can win. You can't take out a copter with an antiquated gun. You're just a target sitting in the sun, waiting for your death to come raining from the sky, where the end really is nigh. You can hear a sonic boom and see a flashing light every hour of the day, every hour of the night in Gaza. There are no shelters, nowhere you can hide. Life is nothing like it is on the other side. There's nothing post about the traumatic stress. There's never more, usually less. And still some people wonder, they insist on asking why anyone would be so mad as to reply, so mad as to think that it might make sense to lob some missiles over the fence from Gaza.
That's David Rovics from the album Palestine in Love. And David, the situation in Palestine is deteriorating, as we know, and the peace effort collapsed or was forced to collapse. And your next song is entitled Occupation. So tell us a little bit about that, and we'll go ahead and we want to hear that one as well.
So many of these songs that I wrote about Palestine were inspired by arguments with people who are defending Israel. You know, it's just every time I write a song or every time there's something happening, there's a flare-up and things are in the news again, then there's always this back and forth and people, you know, pouring bile on each other over the internet and stuff. And, you know, one of the things that happens is they, you know, the apologists for the Israeli regime are all over the place, including in my inbox. And there's always people saying the problem is this or that. It has to do with whatever the most recent violence coming from a Palestinian faction, overlooking any violence that went in their direction. And I wrote this song, Occupation, back in, I think, around 2002, just to basically make the point that it's the problem is the occupation.
All right. Well, let's move forward and hear that song.
Ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself, pointing out you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other is the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For the one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army, by decrees, caterpillars maul the streets, destroy whole city blocks, while children swallow shrapnel for the crime of throwing rocks. Fences are erected around the towns they flatten, and hurt soul fanatics sleep on sheets of satin. And they water their plantations, drilling ever deeper wells, while the displaced children of the hopeless are filled with bullet shells. The word you need to know is occupation, very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the settlers return to Tel Aviv. On one side there's the most facade, rounding up the men thrown in jail with no trial, being tortured once again. On the other, there is rage, helplessness and fear, and a growing realization that another Holocaust is near. On the outside, there are prisons, the inside detainees being stripped of their humanity, beaten naked to their knees. Outside the ghetto walls, stormtroopers all around, while inside the hungry people yearn for liberated ground. The words you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the jail guards return to Tel Aviv. World, you can hear the people say the children of Jerusalem will be free one day. In overcrowded camps amidst the stench of death and flies to the suburbs of Detroit, you can hear the anguish cries. While in the land of Israel, with God ever on their side, walls and fences are constructed, papers are denied. People fight for their existence while we turn a blinded eye, and those who should know better insist on asking why. The words you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It will come on the day the refugees return to Tel Aviv.
You are listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon, filling in for Mickey Huff. He's in studio with Dr. Peter Phillips, and we are talking to David Rovix. That was his song, Occupation. David, before we listen to that song, you were mentioning about the conversations you find yourself in, these passionate debates here in the United States over the conflict in Gaza. And I was wondering, why is it you think there is this passionate debate here in the United States amongst people over what's going on in that region?
I think basically there's a lot of reasons for that, but here in the United States, more than anywhere outside of Israel, it's just all very, very personal for people. For one thing, because a lot of those Israeli Jews who are killing people in Palestine were people that I grew up with in New York City. So these are people not just from the United States, but from New York. So for me, as a New Yorker, it's very personal. I mean, it is the definition of personal. And also, as U.S. taxpayers, we are responsible for this apartheid government of Israel to continue to be an apartheid state and to make war on its neighbors since 1948. We are responsible for that. It's with our money and our weapons that they're doing these things, committing these daily atrocities. So there's people who fall down on one side or the other of that question. And in the Jewish community, which is very large in the United States compared to anywhere else in the world other than Israel, there are basically two ways that people come down on this issue, because anybody who's from any kind of Jewish lineage, regardless of whether they are attached to that from a religious perspective or cultural perspective or whatever, everybody has been profoundly affected by the Nazi Holocaust, just by the fact that it happened. You know, even if you don't personally have family members that die, you know, everybody's been affected. And there are two main ways that people have come down since that period, you know, and when it comes to Israel and when it comes to the conduct of any government that claims to be a Jewish state, you know. And the two main ways people come down is the way that much of the Israeli population has come down on this question is never again to us, screw everybody else. And the way that many Jews in the United States, particularly on the left, where you find a disproportionate number of American Jews, the way people have come down here, it's much more likely to be never again to anyone, including Palestinians or other Arabs, you know. So there's a lot of people here, like me, who are absolutely horrified to see Jews putting other people into into ghettos and building walls around the ghettos, not letting food in, and then bombing the ghetto. There's not many historical examples that are similar to that people can come up with aside from Warsaw. You know, so naturally we think of Warsaw, and we're right to think of Warsaw. What's going on there is ethnic cleansing. It's genocide. There's no word that's too strong to condemn the behavior of the Israeli government now and in the past.
So this is really an issue of the Israeli government over killing, literally, because the death ratios remain 20 to 1, 50 to 1, 100 to 1, depending on what time period we're looking at. But certainly right now, it's in excess of 20 to 1 Palestinians dying for any Israeli soldier that's died. Really, only one civilian has died from the rocket firing. So we're seeing a severe crisis in Gaza for people that are literally trapped in an environment of war.
Yeah.
And so your energy, your feelings about this come forward in your music and this whole album. Now, how many songs are on this album, Love Songs from Palestine?
21
songs. So it's a full exposure of this. And certainly hearing this and listening to it, you can't help but feel the sentimentality and the issues in a very strong way. So, David, thank you for that.
Thank you.
The other album that we're looking at that you have today, the new CD, it's called All the News That's Fit to Sing. Now, that, of course, comes right down Project Censored's line in terms of the New York Times thing of all the news that's fit to print, and then they have a lot of news that doesn't fit. So this All the News That's Fit to Sing, what's this album about from your perspective? And we're going to play that title song here in a minute. So tell us a little bit about this CD.
I mean, it's basically about what's been in the news for the past 6 months, different things that have happened, and which is what I often write about. But I thought, but then when I wrote the song, All the News That's Fit to Sing, I thought that would make a good title, because like many of my albums, that's what the album is about, you know. So unlike the Palestine album, it's not a themed album. It's just whatever I've written over the past few months. But it is basically an album full of the news, including my friend Muzan Beg's arrest in England last March, the mudslide in Oso, Washington last March, you know, different things that have happened over the past few months, including, and the title track is not actually about the particular event. It's just about basically how what I do is sing about the news, and it's also basically listening to a Phil Oakes album, to the first one that he put out on a record label, which is called All the News That's Fit to Sing. And I thought, well, he never wrote a title track for that album, and so I thought I'd write one.
Well, let's just go right in and hear that track, and then we'll get back to you, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's war on for your mind, it's right there on your screen. Watch the pundits ramble on to find the term and set the scene. Hear the pundits say this is the best that it can get. There may be room for improvement. Just stay tuned to your set, just stay tuned to your set. They'll tell you all you need to know. If it's anything important, they'll have it on the show. There's a war on for the planet, there's a war on for your mind. The outcome of the struggle is the fate of humankind. You can drink the Kool-Aid, buy the goods that you are sold. Watch the talking heads, think the way you're told. Think the way they tell you, hold fast to the lies. Or stick your finger in the wind and trust your ears and eyes. Turn off your TV or you won't learn a thing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing. Some democracies are tyrannies, you can hear them say, while some dictatorships are friendly. They'll tell us every day, if your passion is pro baseball, you can surely get the score. But if you want to know what's happening, walk outside your door, see the oil train exploding, see the black smoke in the sky, see the kids under the bridge, see the limo passing by. Turn off your TV or you won't learn a thing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing. It's a question for the moment, a question for the ages, for the businessmen and prisoners rattling their cages, for the businessmen and prisoners, be they lost or found upon the rising oceans or cracked dry desert ground. It's a choice that we're all faced with, or so it seems to me. I don't have all the answers, but I can guarantee, turn off your TV or you won't learn a thing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing. Turn off your TV or you won't learn a thing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing. Gather round, I'll give you all the news that's fit to sing.
This is the Project Censored Show from Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with Dr. Peter Phillips. Our guest is the political singer-songwriter David Rovics. We're about to hear another song by Mr. Rovics. From his album All the News That's Fit to Sing, here's a song called TPP 101. TPP, again, stands for Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's a NAFTA-style trade deal being negotiated in secret by world leaders and corporate leaders. Let's listen to Rovics' song, TPP 101.
Free traders and traitors, bankers and thieves are at it once again. WTO just didn't cut it, so now there's no telling when they'll pass this latest treaty from behind closed doors. Win another battle in the transnational class wars. They want fast-track authority so they can get the job done right, by which they mean no discussion, don't even pretend to put up a fight, as they take from us our government's ability to regulate what happens within the borders of what they used to call the state. And what they used to call democracy, the idea that people have a say in whether we should be building windmills or fracking our lives away, whether banking regulations are a good idea or not, whether the food on your kitchen table comes from a Monsanto plot, whether the poor should die or have affordable medication, whether human life is less important than your corporation, whether this world is a commons or just a free trade bill that we need about as much as we need another oil spill. So let's do like we do in the WC and flush the TPP. Economy, and they've said it all before, like when they implemented NAFTA in 1994. The U.S. lost a million jobs, of this there is no doubt. And in Mexico, small farmers were almost completely wiped out. And when the refugees started streaming in, they were treated just like tools in the great game of the oligarchs, the old divide and rule. Just like J.P. Morgan said, why worry, he laughed, when I can pay half the working class to kill the other half. So let's do like we do in the WC and flush the TPP. SOPA, PIPA, ACTA, they couldn't get them passed, so now they've snuck them all into TPP. Try running that one up the mast. In the back room, no one knows which corporation speaks, except when secret documents get sent to WikiLeaks. And it's only from the whistleblowers we even know it's there. One for Asia, one for Europe, free trade everywhere. Free trade, free pollution, freedom for the billionaires, enslavement for the rest of us, but hey, they got theirs. So let's do like we do in the WC and flush the TPP. do like we do in the WCN. Flush the TPP.
You are listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with Dr. Peter Phillips, and we've been listening to the great songs from David Rovics off his CDs Love Songs for Palestine and All the News That's Fit to Sing. David Rovics, thank you very much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
David, it's great to have you. So we really appreciate your music, and thank you very much for being on.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Keep on keeping on.
Okay, we're going to bring Mickey on. Mickey Huff is joining us live from Petaluma, where he got in late last night on a trip from Washington, D.C., where he was at the National Whistleblowers Conference. He's going to tell us about that. Mickey, are you with us?
I am, Peter.
Wonderful. Mickey, tell us what happened in Washington, D.C.
The Whistleblower Summit is an amazing event. This was the eighth year it's happening, and it was also the first year of celebrating what is called National Whistleblowers Appreciation Day, which is July 30th. And, you know, it was just an amazing event. Project Censored was awarded with something called the Pillar Award, which is quite a prestigious award for being a persons of conscience in new media and journalism. So we were honored to go to Washington, D.C. for the Whistleblower Summit and to be given this award. Marcel Reed and Michael McCrae from Acorn 8 are major organizers of this event. And, of course, we spent a lot of time there with Arlene Engelhart, former Pacifica director, Medea Benjamin, a whole host of people, including folks from the National Whistleblower Center, Stephen Cohn, and Tom Devine of Government Accountability Project. Just an amazing congregation of people that are all about what we're about at Project Censored: free speech, protecting free speech, protecting and promoting free press principles, and protecting those people that stand in the face of adversity and do one of the more selfless things people can do, and that's put the interests of society and the interests of others before themselves. And we hear a lot of attacking of whistleblowers. There's been, as we know, in the Censored 2014 book that Andy and I did, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times, the 2014 book, that's exactly what whistleblowers exemplify. They put themselves behind. They put society up front. They speak fearlessly in fateful times. And this Whistleblower Summit is really a lot of positive news in a lot of ways about headway that's being made. One thing that developed here just recently as a result of the people in Washington, National Whistleblower Center and Government Accountability Project and so on, is that Senator Patrick Leahy has introduced legislation to help close some of the metadata collection with NSA. Bill of Rights Defense Committee is also working on that. And so it's interesting that we certainly can be cynical about the times we live in, and certainly Obama's war on whistleblowers has been unprecedented in our history, really, and the climate for people to come out and tell the truth and speak truth about corruption and malfeasance, or Chelsea Manning and WikiLeaks and the collateral murder videos. I mean, it's just really astounding. And of course, people pay heavy prices for these things. 35 years in prison for Manning, Edward Snowden over a year later, still living in exile, basically, in Russia, Julian Assange living in the Ecuadorian embassy in England. I mean, this is riveting. So these people are under assault. But like I said, there's stuff to celebrate here in terms of, you know, pointing out the importance of whistleblowers. People are fighting to protect whistleblowers. And what we need is a media and a free press that supports these stories and tells these people's stories and gives voice to the voiceless. Instead, what we have is a government that more often tends to shoot the messenger, so to speak, and the media kind of piles on and says that whistleblowers are disgruntled employees and so on. I mean, this is just nonsense, and it's propaganda to try to hide the corruption that goes on at the highest level of
Mickey,
our government. Yes.
Well, you know, we're hearing this. This is important material, and certainly we're proud, Project Censored's proud, to win a national award for being a whistleblower in terms of human rights and protecting whistleblowers. We're so glad that that's happened. Now, how does this play into the Censored 2015 book? Now, you and Andy have been working on this book now. Tell us about the book, what's happening with 2015, and what are the key issues now? How does that relate to whistleblowers, and highlight what's going on?
Well, yeah, Andy Roth and I, who just came back from Washington, have been working on this book for months now. We have a great foreword by Ralph Nader. We've got great artwork on the cover from Josh McPhee of Just Seeds. And the subtitle of the book is Inspiring We the People. And this book is chock full of examples of stories of how we need to take action and deal with our collective societal problems, but it's also about solutions and solutions journalism. One of the key ways that the content in the book this year is overlapping with some of the stuff we were just doing in Washington in Whistleblowers Week is our Media Democracy in Action chapter has some pieces by Patrice McDermott of Open the Government. So this is, again, very, very significant piece. Dave Moss of Electronic Frontier Foundation has a piece in the book. Shahid Batar, whom I was just with in Washington at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, has a fantastic piece in here. These are just really great folks doing great work, and we're honored to have them in Censored 2015. In our Deja Vu chapter every year, where we go back and look at what's happened with previous stories, you know, our top story from Censored 2014 was Chelsea Manning and how the corporate media framed that, distorted that, didn't want to cover the actual stories of the leaked documents and what they said about the U.S. empire and wanton murder and violation of both international and domestic laws. And this year, in the Deja Vu chapter, we look at that because when this book was going to press last year, that's when the Edward Snowden story was breaking, and Andy and I, we kind of joke around, and we even say in this year's introduction, you know, we can't stop to take the world's temperature, so to speak. You know, as we're writing the book, life keeps happening, things keep happening and developing very quickly. So we find ourselves saying, as this book goes to press, well, this year we had a lot to go back and look at in terms of Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and how they've been treated and what's going on with their stories. And, of course, since last year's book came out, Glenn Greenwald is involved in The Intercept. And at any rate, the stories that he has been publishing, of course, are, you know, quite damning about what's been happening on the highest levels inside the NSA that the government would rather we not know. I mean, and what we've been finding out, of course, since James Clapper lied to Congress, with impunity, I might add, lied to Congress about the spying and the metadata programs and so forth. Now we find the CIA is coming out even admitting that they were spying on the Senate subcommittee with Dianne Feinstein that was investigating the CIA. And nothing is being done about these issues on the highest level. So in the book this year, we go back and we take a look at these things, and particularly the deja vu, you know, right, it's deja vu all over again. And we see these people basically in the corporate media and higher levels of government attacking anybody that wants to tell the counter narrative or the counter stories. So we see people attacking Glenn Greenwald, David Gregory over at NBC attacking him and saying, are you even a real journalist? People in the U.S. framing, the corporate media framing Edward Snowden as a hero or traitor, or worse at NBC, they've been particularly egregious. Is he a traitor or criminal? Right? I mean, so there's really no room for discourse in corporate media to look at what are these people actually telling us. So it becomes a story of Edward Snowden instead of the story about the documents he leaked. And that's the real problem. And corporate media, of course, doesn't want to investigate that. Just like they didn't do it with Chelsea Manning, they've been piling on and attacking Greenwald and Snowden all year long. And the hidden story, of course, there is how our national security is outsourced. Booz Allen Hamilton, 99% of their money as a contractor came from public money, but yet they are not subject to the same kind of oversights. Therefore, the way the laws are written, people that whistleblow there don't have the same protections. And, of course, that's what this whole week in the summit was about, was how do we strengthen and protect people that want to do the right thing, right? That was actually one of the key things at the conference, I think, that ties in so strongly to the work that we all do at Project Censored. Certainly, you know, you, Peter, for so many years, almost two decades of the work. And Nolan, Nolan Higdon helps us with the Junk Food News chapters and so many other things. We're honored to have such a great team. One of the interesting themes here is it right, right? Is it right? And that was one of the big quotes from the conference that goes and looks at Martin Luther King's great quote, where King said, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but we must take it because our conscience tells us that it's right. And for 38 years, Project Censored has been trying to catapult the stories of independent journalists and whistleblowers that do the right thing, want to tell us what's going on.
Mickey, we appreciate it. Thank you for coming in with us. We're going to turn to a clip from Project Censored, the movie, but thank you for joining us.
Great to be on, great to talk about the book, and good luck, you guys.
we want to cover a piece of the DVD, the Project Censored, the movie on capitalism. I think that's a vital thing. And let's go ahead and hear that clip.
The wars get packaged. They get prepared. So, like, you know, you hire Rendon Group. That's a PR firm that likes to do wars. They did Panama. They specialize in. They work for Clinton. They work for Bush.
Well, in Iraq, when the American media like to show the missiles taking off, Al Jazeera says we like to show what happens when they land, which is censored in this country.
We spend more on the military than the rest of the world combined. A budget of $711 billion this year on U.S. military expenditures. We have 725 bases worldwide.
In the United States, the discretionary budget is about 60% military. However, if you look at all the spin-offs, all of the military programs that then affect insurance companies and healthcare companies and food vendors and suppliers and the banking industry, all of that feeds into that 60%, it's probably closer to 80%.
We need to talk about the war as a new economy. We need to talk about the fact that many of the major news networks are deeply embedded in this economy. One of the most dramatic examples of this is General Electric, which owns NBC. GE is one of the biggest players in the so-called homeland security sector. Check the logos on the side of all the machines at the airports. The more afraid we are, the more money they make.
GE is a bomb maker. NBC is not going to be against war. Simple as that. It's not even that they generally sympathize with companies that are their advertisers, or that they... No, it's that they are the problem. NBC equals GE equals military industrial complex. End of story.
When I was an economic hitman, officially I worked for a consulting firm called Charles C. Maine in Boston. We had about 2,000 employees, consultants, professional people. My official title was chief economist. I was a partner in the firm, and I had several dozen people working for me. That was my official title. But really, tongue-in-cheek, I was an economic hitman, which essentially is a con artist. And we could use all the resources of this company to create economic models and so forth that would prove to countries like Panama, Ecuador, Indonesia, countries with resources our corporations covet.
We economic hitmen have managed to create the world's first truly global empire, and it's basically a secret empire. We do it many ways, but principally, we identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. The money never actually goes to the country. It goes to our own corporations to build the infrastructure projects in that country that help a few very wealthy people, but don't benefit the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity or have cars to drive on the highways, and yet they're left holding a huge debt that they can't repay. So we go back at some point and say, you know, you can't pay your debts. Give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies. Vote with us on the next critical UN vote. Allow us to build a military base in your backyard. Something along these lines. And when we fail, the jackals go in and either overthrow or assassinate these leaders. And if the jackals fail, as they did in Iraq, then we send in the military. I don't think the failure is capitalism. I think it's a specific kind of capitalism that we've developed. We've created what I consider a mutant viral form of capitalism. And this mutant form of capitalism, which I think is really a predatory form of capitalism, has created an extremely unstable, unsustainable, unjust, and very, very dangerous world. I've met a lot of terrorists. I've interviewed them for books. I've never met one who wanted to be a terrorist. They're desperate people. If we want to get rid of terrorism, we must get rid of the root causes, that cancer that is destroying our whole system. Because I think it's really important that we understand today we cannot have homeland security unless we understand that the whole planet is our homeland.
For the enemies, we can apply rational standards. For ourselves, not. And this enters into even choice of coverage. So take, say, Africa. There's extensive coverage of Darfur a lot of protest movements and so on. And it's a major atrocity. There should be. It's not the worst atrocity in Africa, not even close. I mean, Eastern Congo, the number of deaths in roughly the same years is probably 10 times as high. It's a monstrous atrocity. Almost no coverage.
Most people don't recognize the level of death that's occurred in the Congo and the wars there, which is a significant story. Over 5 million people have died in the Congo since the war started there, the civil wars and that, mostly over mineral wealth. And that we all carry with us a piece of the Congo, and that's coltan in our cell phones, which is a mineral that 80% of it is comes from the Rift Valley in the Congo. Corporations fight over it, military fight over it. Lockheed Martin can't go to work. I mean, they can't go to work without it.
In Eastern Congo, the criminals are transnational corporations and states that back them, who are tearing the country to shreds because they want mineral resources.
I mean, we're reaching levels of death almost on par with World War II in Europe in one country, the Congo. So that's a massive story that hasn't been widely understood in the United States.
Well, that's just not the right kind of story. So, in fact, there's nothing, almost nothing about it.
That was the voice of Noam Chomsky, one of the many commentators who appear in Project Censored, the movie. This documentary is about more than Project Censored. It's a look at the structure of media in the U.S. and what's wrong with it. This documentary was produced by Christopher Oscar and Doug Hecker. Now let's hear another excerpt, this one about how corporate media outlets censor themselves.
Implicitly, we have a concentrated, top-down corporate media system that's primarily oriented to make money and provide entertainment, and is increasingly a propaganda machine for the military media industrial complex of the United States.
The stations used to be family-owned. Guess what? They're all gone. They're all owned by multinational corporations.
The country is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves and not for the benefit of the population.
Well, the corporate media does it by the book. They do the time-life approach. They go down the middle. They never say anything too controversial. If you try, like, to criticize Westmoreland in Vietnam, you get into a whole scandal like Dan Rather did, and you don't get away with that stuff. So as a result, they barrier everything to death, and it becomes sanitized and boring.
The way it works is, and I've been in these conversations, this is how it works on the inside. You have the responsibility for a newscast. And every morning the school board lights up. Hear the demographics from last night. Here's what you did with Network X. Here's what your competition did. By the way, they handed your head to you last night because we think they concentrated on the story most people wanted to hear. Paris Hilton, murder case on the West Coast. You insisted on leading with something, an international story. And here's what Network Y did. That's the way the pressure works on you.
Censorship is one of our most serious problems, if not the most serious problem. And I think we have to look at censorship as taking many different forms. But there's this much more subtle form of censorship, which is exercised every day by the mainstream press. Mainstream press is a good way to put it, where the owners censor it. I talked recently to a very high-up reporter in one of the major U.S. newspapers, the New York Times, and he said, you know, I'm not censored. I can write anything I want and turn it into my editor, but he decides what to publish and what not to publish. And if he doesn't publish any of my stories for a couple of weeks, I lose my job. So theoretically, I'm not censored. Nobody puts black lines through sentences. It's not the old-fashioned form, but he's censored.
Fear permeates every newsroom in the country. One of the fears is that our circulation will go down, or our ratings will go down, or our demographic will go down. And I do not accept myself in this criticism. It is, listen, somebody else is running the story that I don't think ought to be the lead story. But for 10 days, they've been on a ratings climb and we've been on a ratings decline. And the reason entertainment values have reached the point where they've almost tsunami-like overwhelmed news values is this reality. If you continue to lose demographics, you continue to lose in the ratings, you probably aren't going to last.
Good evening, and welcome to CMM, the Corporate Mainstream Media News Network. I'm Hallie Burton. In today's news, Americans are breathing a sigh of relief as Congress has agreed to bail out our struggling banking industry, saving our country from a deeper recession and economic collapse. In other news, Lindsay Lohan was implicated for allegedly stealing jewelry. And Charlie Sheen, he's back in rehab.
The corporations control the world today. There was a time not so long ago, a few hundred years ago, when geopolitics of the world was controlled by religious organizations. And then it was governments. And you had some totalitarian governments, you had some democratic governments, but governments really ran things. Today it's the big corporations.
The antitrust safeguards that had been put there around back in the 30s had been completely dismantled or ignored by the courts. So we need to go back to basics and enforce our own rules. The elites have gotten to a point where they're above the rules, as we are seeing now with the economy. And that's obscured by our media, who are complicit and part of the same clique. And we need to dismantle all of that through reforms and just say, no, let's go back. The rules actually say this. We need to enforce this.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. This is Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. For the last segment of the show today, the last five so odd minutes we have, we'd like to call attention to a couple of guys that have been making a film about media censorship. So that's certainly right up our alley.
In 1996, Congress passed the Telecommunications Act, which led to a gold rush of media mergers and takeovers in the United States. Today, fewer than five major media corporations dominate U.S. news and information systems.
As a student of Project Censored, we discussed the spin that corporate media used when describing the Telecommunications Act of 1996. It was supposed to create competition among media corporations, ultimately benefiting the American public with increased relevant news.
You've been traveling around the country for the last 5 years now, getting this kind of footage, right? And you're putting together this story of media censorship, propaganda.
The fact that we have censorship in our media is not an occurrence that happens because of ignorance. It is something that happens because of deliberate policy.
What the corporate media do, basically, is they parrot the arguments of the administration. They don't challenge the administration, they report the administration, but in reporting them, they are giving the administration the airwaves. They're giving them the platform. They're crowding out everything else. They're not reporting the views of the opposition. And so all that the public gets is the statements of the political leaders of the country.
I get invited to be on right-wing radio and right-wing TV because they want to have some lefty straw man that they can slap around. So I've been on Hannity and Combs and Greta Van Susteren and those kind of shows. And it's interesting, Hannity and Combs, you see how it works. You're in a remote studio, you got super bright lights in your face, you can't see the camera, you got no monitors, you can't see what they're doing. And you've got a little earpiece in your ear that when it comes time for you to talk, they turn up the volume on the B-roll at some demonstration, and Hannity is saying, I want you to denounce these violent protesters. I say, well, I denounce all violence. Yeah, but I want you to denounce these particular protesters. And unless you say what they want you to say, they're not going to let you continue. They're going to keep interrupting you.
We can see this quite clearly in the news coverage after the 9/11 attacks. Has media's criticism of the government become unpatriotic?
I know what
I
was doing.
Shut up. In respect for your father, who was a Port Authority worker, a fine American, who got killed unnecessarily by barbarians.
By radical extremists,
yeah, fine.
Trained by
right.
this government.
Respect
not
for
the
him.
People of America.
I'm not going to address
the ruling class, a small minority.
Cut his mic.
There has to be really, really clear separation between the media and the government and media and corporations.
The media has a tremendous influence in the development of public policy and in the way in which public policy is implemented.
The American public are the true owners of the American airways in America, not the corporations.
You take away that family pride, community owned, and you no longer have any kind of compelling reason to tell the real truth and to really go underneath the layers and cover a community like it needs to be covered.
I get invited to be on right-wing radio and right-wing TV because they want to have some lefty straw man that they can slap around. So I've been on Hannity and Combs and Greta Van Susteren and those kind of shows. And it's interesting, Hannity and Combs, you see how it works. You're in a remote studio, you got super bright lights in your face, you can't see the camera, you got no monitors, you can't see what they're doing, and you've got a little earpiece in your ear that when it comes time for you to talk, they turn up the volume on the B-roll at some demonstration, and Hannity is saying, I want you to denounce these violent protesters. I say, well, I denounce all violence. Yeah, but I want you to denounce these particular protesters. And unless you say what they want you to say, they're not going to let you continue. They're going to keep interrupting you.
We can see this quite clearly in the news coverage after the 9/11 attacks. Has media's criticism of the government become unpatriotic?
I know what
Shut
I was
up.
Doing.
Shut up.
In respect for your father, who was a port authority worker, a fine American, who got killed unnecessarily by barbarians.
By radical extremists,
yeah.
Fine. Trained by this government.
Respect
not
for
the
him.
People of America,
I'm not
the people, the ruling
you.
Class, a small minority.
Cut his mic.
There has to be really, really clear separation between the media and the government and media and corporations.
The media has a tremendous influence in the development of public policy. And in the way in which public policy is implemented.
The American public are the true owners of the American airways in America, not the corporations.
You take away that family pride, community owned, and you no longer have any kind of compelling reason to tell the real truth and to really go underneath the layers and cover a community like it needs to be covered.
The information that the public gets is very poor. They are not told the truth about what is going on. And so the corporate media, simply play a role in reinforcing whatever deceptions are being carried out by the government.
We came to the conclusion from a lot of the interviews we conducted with these, we call them critics of corporate mainstream media or former corporate mainstream media anchors, and the really came out of it was you've got this major fear component to news, and also this distraction piece. This let's divide the nation against each other. And when you divided a nation against each other, you know, that's when nations fall victim and prey to war.
If large corporate newspapers and TV stations were to just stop feeding this frenzy of fear and difference.
But they keep us on this sort of on the edge of this cliff. Might happen. Fear is a big factor in telling news in America today. Fear the rain, fear the traffic, fear the mechanic, fear the mailman, fear this, fear that, to the point where you're so uneasy after watching the news, local news, that you feel, well, I watch local news to find out what's happening in my community. Instead, I'm walking away needing a Xanax, you know, because, you know, all they did is scare me. But it's intentional. The marketers say, if you scare them enough, they like that. Scare me. And people will start watching your news.
We just heard an excerpt from Project Censored, the movie, a documentary produced by Christopher Oscar and Doug Hecker. More information about this film can be found at projectcensored.org. And that concludes the program for today. Thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show from Pacifica Radio. Thanks also to our producer Anthony Fess and our engineer Erica Bridgman. Project Censored Show originates at KPFA in Berkeley, California, and airs on more than 15 stations around the U.S. Archives of our previous programs can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook as well. I'm Nolan Higdon with Peter Phillips. See you next time.
rocks in the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.